Welcome to another exciting episode of The NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own.
Welcome, everyone, to The NIDS View, your exclusive deterrence-focused podcast, and where preserving peace and prosperity matters. I'm Jim Petrosky, president and co-founder and your host, and I'm joined by Vice President for Education and co-founder Curtis McGiffin. Glad to have you here today, Curtis.
Glad to be here, Jim. Good to see you.
Yeah, well, it's nice to see you, too, at least virtually. We do need to get together sometime soon, you know. It's nice to know if the person's really there. Well, you know, it's the beginning of another month, Curtis. December 2025. It's time for our NIDS news in review. I'll have to work on that.
You need work on that.
Yeah, got a lot of work to do. Before doing the roundup and moving on, Curtis, do you have any big plans for the holidays? I know you've got new grandchildren and all. Is that right?
I have a new grandchild, yes, yeah. our first, and so I'm definitely looking forward to the holiday season and to enjoy that with a one-year-old, and so that will be a lot of fun, and we're basically staycation kind of folks. Getting on an airplane during any time during the holiday season is something that terrifies me.
I know.
I'm really not interested in subjecting myself or my family to that kind of horror. So we definitely, if we can't drive there in a few hours, we're going to stay home.
Yeah, I understand that.
That's why we moved down to Tennessee, so we could be within driving distance of at least most of the family. And so we try to immerse ourselves in that.
Yeah, well, we have the personal public life here, but also the best plan in the world. My grandkids are about 600 feet away from our house and our closest neighbor, so that works out well. And they're old enough, unlike yours, and these are great times for you. Cherish every minute of it. But our grandkids are next door, and they're already spying on the boxes every time someone shows up at the house, you know, trying to see if they can get a glimpse of what's coming. So, you know, that's the fun to work on. So, well, good. I'm glad to hear you're ready for the holidays. You're going to have a special one. That first year is always really important.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and get started on our looking at some review headlines, just to inform our audience. Curtis and I pick a couple news articles. We don't tell each other because we want you to hear our, you know, unprogrammed setup and response. So we're going to start with this news and review from November 2025. We'll unpack them and look at the future deterrence. So I'll defer my time back to Curtis to get us started. And go ahead, Curtis.
All right, Jim. So for the for the November news roundup, this November was the month. Let me pause here for a moment and just remind our audience, a lot of things happened in November, and on other podcasts we have already discussed the president's edict on nuclear testing, and we do discuss a lot about China and Russia and these sorts of things. So these news articles maybe a little bit more hidden away, tucked away off the headlines, but they're still interesting and have meaning. So one thing I'll note here is November was the month. This is a weird one, Jim. It's the month of nuclear cruise missiles. All right. Now, we have also already talked about Russia's testing of the nuclear-armed cruise missile. I'm not talking about that, although that did happen in November.
Yeah.
I'm talking about a couple of other pieces. So I'm going to conflate about three different articles here because they all happened this month.
Is this going to count as all three of your three?
No, this is one. This is one.
And then you complain we go over time. Go ahead, Curtis.
It's magically delicious, so we're going to make it all one. All right, okay. So Bill Gertz in the Washington Times reported on November 13th that for the first time, the Air Force's new long-range standoff nuclear cruise missile, or the AGM-181, was publicly viewed on the wing of a B-52, which indicates it's out for testing, right? And the LRSO is the new nuclear-armed cruise missile for the Air Force as we look to the modernization out there. Right now, the Air Force plans to buy 1,087 of these missiles, which I believe is woefully inadequate. But in any case, that is the plan right now. It'll carry the W-88 nuclear warhead. And the goal here for the LRSO is it's kind of a stealthy subsonic cruise missile. It's capable of penetrating and surviving advanced integrated air defense systems and from significant standoff ranges. So our jets are out of sort of the threat ring, and we sort of let the missiles do the penetrating, and that provides a deterrence threat that even the enemy's anti-ballistic missile defense and these sorts of things can't reduce the ability to hold at risk. General Wilsbach, who is the new chief of staff of the Air Force, noted in his testimony that this system is one of several, maybe few, that is currently on cost and on schedule within its performance criteria. Yay. So that is good news. Yeah, round of applause for the good guys. Now, to caveat that, our allies, the French, also tested a new nuclear-armed cruise missile called the ASMP A-R, which is an extended modern version of their ASMP. It's all French. I'm not going to try to say all those words. I don't speak French. But essentially, these are cruise missiles that have a shorter range, maybe 400 to 500 kilometers, and carry a warhead that is a dial of yield. But get this, Jim, the low end of this dial of yield is 100 kilotons, and the high end is 300 kilotons. And, of course, this version of the ASMPA-R is for the Navy, which makes the French aircraft carrier, the Charles de Gaulle, the only aircraft carrier, at least in the free world, that is capable and can be regularly armed with nuclear cruise missiles. Not the United States, the French.
Yep.
And so this is a note here about how the French commitment to nuclear deterrence at all threat levels, and it's part of their dyad. So their fighter aircraft and the Air Force side carry these missiles as well, but they're a slightly shorter range. But these new ones are going to be for the fleet, for the naval fleet here, for the French. And so it is going to augment the dyad by having a naval capability to do this with a nuke. So this, again, shows value as to what the capability is to have an attack that is a non-ballistic threat to the adversary. And finally, we'll add here that the Chinese are reported to have tested the JL-1 missile for the first time. And this is first shown to the world in the September timeframe during their parade, their 80th anniversary of the end of World War II parade. And the JL-1 is one of these missiles that hangs on the belly of their H-6N bombers, these old bombers from the 50s, these old Soviet style bombers, and they're designed to launch and extend the range, if you will, right, the reach of these bombers by dropping these things out. Now, these missiles are huge. They're like 40 meters long, and these bombers can only carry one of them. And so when you fly these bombers out, which are now air refuelable, into the Pacific or over the northern Pacific, and then launch these missiles, it puts a lot of the United States and Canada at risk, and the nuclear capabilities and enterprise that go along with it. And again, it's not a ballistic vector, so it provides a lot of these challenges. One thing of note, the French missile that I just talked about, the new one, is purported to be hypersonic. Or I'm sorry, they're working on a hypersonic. Forgive me, I'm confusing my articles here. They are purporting to be working now on a hypersonic Mach 5 version. So who one thing's for sure,
Jim, they, the French? French.
Yeah. Yeah, the French. So one thing's for sure, Jim, you know, while America still tries to figure out its hypersonic capabilities and whatnot, the French may have already done that. And perhaps we should place our orders now and maybe we can buy some of theirs.
Yeah, interesting, Curtis. So for the audience, as I said, we pick out articles that are completely separate and not discussed. So, you know, giving Curtis the advance always puts me in a bad position because he scooped one of my articles on this French system. But that's okay because I think, you know, it's really important. I think a couple of things that I want to highlight from a deterrent standpoint is, you know, France's in Europe and Russia's been rattling the sabers. So, of course, whenever you're not in the line of sight or at least think you're in the line of sight, you know, people sort of sit back and, you know, talk about how, oh, well, we shouldn't really think about nuclear weapons. They could be, you know, our capabilities. And then as soon as someone else begins to ramp up, you're like, oh, we got to do stuff. And they're doing stuff. And I think that's good news. I will say, you know, I do think one of the things that that came out in the article that I read, a little different than yours, is, you know, they raised the President Emmanuel Macron raised the prospect of extending France's nuclear umbrella. In other words, we're going to take charge in the European nations amid the threat. And I think that's really important. That's great signaling. That's great shared responsibility. And in these low, you know, in these low yield nuclear weapons that they're talking about delivering, and as you say, they can get in under the radar, they can get in, they provide that threat because you have to make the threat for deterrence to work. They provide that threat that you can do a counter value targeting without a lot of the, you know, major issues of taking out entire cities. Like, you know, it says, hey, we've got good targeting, we've got good accuracy, and we can use low-yield nuclear weapons to take out significant targets. And so I thought that was another piece of this that that came out, at least in the article I read.
Yeah, look, I will note, though, that the French missiles are not necessarily low-yield at 100 kilotons minimum. But and that's part of the problem is neither the French nor the British have these low-yield systems. And so this is, you know, an issue. But what I do appreciate here is that the French are committed to modernizing their nuclear arsenal and the value of deterrence writ large. I have long said, Jim, that if the world can get to a point of disarmament after the Japanese, I'm sorry, excuse me, after the Chinese and the Russians disarm, only then will the French disarm. They would be the last.
Yeah. Yeah. And I apologize. You caught me. I misspoke. Yeah. They have these large yield. My point is they could go to lower yield and make those accurate pieces. And they're not there yet, which was the point I was trying to make was, you know, they're not there, but they can get there because of the accuracy of these weapons. My apologies to our audience and my misspeaking. That's what I meant to say. Yeah. No problem. Okay. Well, you know, in keeping with the theme, I found it an interesting, juicy article for me. You're done, Curtis, right?
I guess. Done, yes.
I'll change it around. No, wait a minute. You're done, Curtis. Okay, now. So I found an article in Breaking Defense that just was near and dear to my heart. And it was came out on the 20th of November in 2025, written by Todd Harrison of the American Enterprise Institute. And the title of this is "The Time to Move ICBMs from the Air Force to the Army is Now." An interesting concept. And of course, for our audience, you know, I was born and raised in the Army. And in my last couple of years, of course, I spent, you know, sort of bridging the gap between the Air Force and the Army. And I have a deep respect for the Air Force and I have a great love for the Army. I think that Todd makes some very, very interesting points. And of course, keeping with the missile theme from November, although we'll break from that eventually, maybe, you know, he starts out by again, taking a quote from the Air Force Chief of Staff, General Wilsbach, who says, "At our core, we fly and fix aircraft. That's the heart of what we do." And he's, you know, importantly, what you see is that missiles are not flying or fixing aircraft. They're something different. And so the ICBMs, you know, ended up, you know, because of the space and rocketry and everything else that the Air Force was involved in. Now we have a Space Force. Maybe that'll change out a little bit. But what he really talks about is that, you know, this sort of is an odd duck for the Air Force to be managing the ICBMs for a couple reasons. And I thought it was a great article, at least to look at it, because we are in a process modernizing our ICBM fleet. And I'm sure we're going to get a lot of hits from a lot of people in the ICBM fleet. Saying, well, I'm not sure about this. Change is difficult. Let's take a look at some of the main reason that this was brought out. First of all, you know, they're simply not part of the core of the Air Force identity or mission. They'll never be, because airplanes flying, that's what they do. They put airplanes in the sky. They need to keep the focus there, because I think we do need to expand our air power. A, you know, an aircraft that is able to, you know, drop a bomb or shoot a missile from the sky, and developing that. The second piece, and this is something I think the Air Force is working on correcting, but there's been several studies. I think late 2000s, there were multiple reports about the missile career field being forgotten by the Air Force in some ways. And I've met many of the people that get forgotten in that missile career field, because it's a little different. It's a different promotion path. It's a different set of training. And so the missile operators basically train and work separately. They have different command structure. They're trying to integrate a little bit better. And that experience and the commands, et cetera, are completely different from the junior listed all the way through the senior leadership roles there. And so that's another indicator that maybe it could go somewhere else. And, you know, this has happened multiple times within the Air Force, these studies. I just remember, I think it was a 2014 study or something that I worked with some folks in looking at AFIT when we were looking at missileers coming and getting their nuclear suites. And then, of course, you know, third, the way that missile fields are dispersed and placed out there is more of a ground mission. What is it? You know, they have helicopters. The only use for them really is priority there is to fly the crews between the silos. The Air Force, the Army has a much better, handle on the helicopter issue versus the pilots that fly those, the maintainers, the security forces, the pipelines, the communications, all that in the ICBM mission is all mainly a ground mission. And so I think that would really help out. And then I'll throw my last piece here. You know, the Army's really involved already in missiles. I mean, they have silo-based missiles, the ground-based interceptors up in Greeley, Alaska, my favorite state, by the way. Nothing against Ohio, but Alaska's just absolutely beautiful. And, you know, out at Vandenberg, you know, they run those. So it's part of the Army mission already. And turning that over to the Army would give them, you know, you already got a lot of expertise in the Army in the FA-52s, the functional area 52s with the nuclear mission, understanding nuclear survivability, et cetera. It's not a large change. Now, I'm going to open the door here and I'll let Curtis speak, but I'm going to say there's going to be a knee jerk from the Air Force, obviously, because losing anything is not good necessarily. But if it's good for the Army, it's good for the Air Force, it's good for the country, it's something to think about now while we're doing this transition. So it's time to look at this from a strategic standpoint. It's time to look at it from an operational standpoint and a mission standpoint. And so that's the article I saw, I thought was a great start. And as a think tank, we should think about these things. So I've already, you know, started turning up my creative juices to start thinking about this, maybe work with a couple of people to look at this more broadly. So Curtis, what are your thoughts being Air Force indoctrined neophyte for the Air Force? Go ahead.
So it's just a great piece, Jim. I'm glad you found it. So as an Air Force guy who was both an aviator mm-hmm. and a nuke guy, mm-hmm. Flying airborne command and control aircraft, I can see both sides of this. Let me start by saying this. This is the consequences of having a brand new chief of staff of the Air Force who, I don't know, it may not be completely well-versed in the nuclear mission, because the core of the Air Force is not to fly and fix airplanes. It has been disinterested in this for decades. Mm-hmm. It relieved itself of the looking glass mission to the Navy. in the late 90s, didn't care about flying that mission. So I'm not a firm believer that is the issue. The core mission of the Air Force is not to fly and fix airplanes. It is to do deterrence. Flying and fixing airplanes is part of the means to execute that strategy of deterrence, as are the ICBMs, which have been in the Air Force for 60 plus years. So this is a huge, I think, political faux pas on the part of the new chief of staff. You should never work to alienate portions of your own service. I would say this. I would imagine that the cyber operators feel very similar because the Air Force has a core mission in cyber warfare as well. So, and it already has chopped off its space mission, right, into a new service. So I think the Air Force is a tremendous risk of slowly whittling away its core mission sets. You know, why don't we go even further, Jim? I mean, prior to 1947, where was the Air Force? Okay. So they'll
find their way eventually.
I will be very careful here. Yeah. But with all that being said, it's not the first time I've heard people consider that the land-based leg of the ICBM should be a part of the land-based service. And of course, adding that into the Army's mission profile would be interesting, though I will point out that offensive ballistic missiles have not been part of the Army inventory since 1983, I guess, with the retirement of the Pershing II. But in any case, there are certainly the Army has committed itself to having nuclear experts in its MOS corps. It has definitely committed itself to long-range fires with its various long-range artillery. So there is some interest, I think, in how you might draw the connection to all of this. The question is this a mission the Army would want to take on? And maybe yes, maybe no. There's a lot of consternation in the Navy over the SLCM and these sea-based launched cruise missile nuclear. The Navy is not really excited, I think, about accepting this platform into their mission set. They kind of just want to do the SSBNs and then you know, fight conventional wars in and around the Pacific theater and elsewhere. And so, you know, you'd have to make sure that that's something the Army would want to take. And we can't just assume that just because there's a money trail that they're willing to take those sorts of things on. So I would encourage the chief of staff of the Air Force and any of the people who work for him that might be listening to this podcast to get with him and understand that every time you say things that alienate the other parts of the Air Force, you essentially alienate the other parts of the Air Force, and that's not good for morale or mission function. My opinion, sorry, just going to give it to you.
Yeah, no, there it is. That's what we're here for, and I knew you'd have an interesting and diverse opinion, but I would say, you know, and my last comment on this will be that it does make some sense to pull these together. You know, let's not worry about the money issue. I know that's the big issue, the big cut. But taking care of the people that are on the ground, not making this an extraneous mission, because we see the Air Force going the direction that the chief of staff has gone once again, forgetting that nuclear is a huge deterrence mission that is often forgot about in the Air Force.
Right. Let me add one more caveat. That's important. This. Okay, because the bombers are not necessarily on alert on a day-to-day basis.
They should be.
We deter daily with a dyad. Mm-hmm. The ICBMs, the land-based ICBMs, and the sea-based submarine-launched ballistic missiles. If you remove the ICBMs out of the Air Force will be out of the deterrence business unless it puts its bombers back on alert. So General Wolfsbach would need to be concerned about making sure that there are bombers that are flown and fixed and on alert so that they have a core function in the deterrence triad. And so now If you put bombers back on alert, similar to what we had in the Cold War, now you would have the three largest services each participating in a leg of the triad rather than two and one and another for kind of left out. So that would be an interesting formulation and recommitment to deterrence as a nation in that regard. But I think it would be bad. I think it would be bad. Bad for business for the Air Force to give up its one leg of the triad that is arguably the least costly, most ready in its inventory. No aircraft in the Air Force inventory has the readiness rate of an ICBM.
Nope, I agree. No, and that's but the bombers on alert is, you know, maybe by moving this mission over to the Army, you put the focus on the bombers on alert. You have the time, the effort, the strength to do that. I'm just saying there are options here. It's worth considering, and I do agree with Todd Harrison. If we're going to do it, now is the time to begin thinking about that, and I'm glad he brought up this article. So thank you, Todd Harrison. So back to you, Curtis, on your next article.
All right, well, I'm kind of bouncing around between these two articles I have left. I'm going to do this, the third one, second, because it kind of plays into my first piece and some of the conversation we had. And this one's a pretty quick one. But just this this month here on November 19th in Europe, oddly enough, the chairman of Airbus, René Obermann, was making a presentation, and he called upon the European countries to acquire tactical nuclear weapons in response to a threat posed by the Russian Iskander missiles now being based at Kaliningrad. Quote, "Our Achilles heel seems to be what Russia threatens us with fairly publicly. That's 500-plus tactical nuclear warheads on Iskander 26 missiles stationed right in front of our door in Kaliningrad, in addition to the newly stationed ones in Belarus," Obermann said at the Berlin Security Conference on Wednesday. This was reported by Reuters. So I don't know the charismatic significance of the Airbus CEO. I would imagine Airbus is probably one of the largest industries in Europe, one of the largest companies in Europe. It encompasses multiple countries within the European Union. This was probably similar to, forgive me, but I'm just trying to draw some sort of, this would be like Elon Musk standing in front of some presentation going, "We need more ballistic missiles that SpaceX could build in order to ensure more deterrence. We need more." I think it's that kind of influence. And so for an industry leader of one of these large companies that, you know, has the potential to build systems to support this, to basically call out that Europe does not have its own tactical nuclear missiles, I think is very important, which goes back to the first conversation that even the French cruise missiles that we talked about, Their yield is so large they can't be classified as tactical. So the only low yield weapons in Europe are the shared nuclear weapons that are obviously in the custody of the U.S. And so he basically challenged European and NATO sort of general officers to think about how to fix this problem. And he said, Obermann warned that Europe risks misunderstanding Moscow's strategy if it focuses only on high-end strategic forces while ignoring Russia's large tactical stockpile. A credible response, he said, would send a massive sign of deterrence. So clearly this CEO gets it, perhaps even more than the politicians that derive policy for NATO and so forth. He understands that we need to be able, Europe needs to be able to deter at the lower ends of the spectrum, because that is where Russia is placing the greatest pressure, the greatest challenge, the greatest threat. And the best way to counter that is to match them, is essentially what this CEO is saying. And so I thought that was very interesting, and it was worth reporting.
Yeah, that sounds good. Did he mention dynamic parity, perhaps, or not really?
He didn't, but we can.
Well, yeah, but so yeah, and that's of course a reference to Curtis's and Adam's great paper on dynamic parity from last year. But yeah, you know, the again, it goes back to my comment about France. You know, once again, you know, nuclear is not cool unless you're being threatened by a nuclear adversary, then suddenly, well, you know, we might need to start thinking about this. Well, maybe you should have thought about it before the threat became real, and deterrence would have worked well ahead of time. You slow things down, you manage them a little bit better, and you have some bargaining chips to work with. And it sounds like that's what they're doing. This is, you know, I've said this many times on the podcast. I would like to see a world without any nuclear weapons, as long as we also don't have conventional weapons, as long as we don't have any way of harming each other, then we should get rid of everything because, you know, obviously, you know, the kumbaya world. But until then, we've got to use the tools that we have in the tool chest to be able to stop these aggressive actions by others. And it looks like that's exactly what they're talking about there. So you frame that out well, Curtis. I really like the perspective that you bring to the deterrence world, because deterrence is really the major factor in all this. So, all right. Well, since Curtis scooped my second article, I had four articles because I always come.
And we're running prepared. Out of time, Jim.
I know, but I'm really torn between two of them. And since we talked about deterrence, we're pretty close to almost out of time. I may leave my since we talked about testing and before, maybe we'll talk about this B6112 testing. That was going to be my second article.
I have that article too.
Yeah. So that was in Newsweek. So I'm going to move to one that I think we'll get Curtis all riled up, because I like to do that. And that is an article on UPI. I can't remember what UPI stands for. It was written by Joe United Fisher.
Press International?
UPS. It came out actually in U.S. News Reports, but it had a UPI underneath. It came out November 6th, and it said, "Experts warn explosive nuclear testing would trigger escalation." Okay, so just for the audience here to understand, we were nuclear testing all the way through 1992. We only ramped up, I think we reached our peak somewhere in the 1968 timeframe between us and Russia. So I'm really not sure why nuclear experts warned that testing, explosive nuclear testing, would trigger escalation. But in the article, they really don't talk so much about nuclear testing, explosive testing. And I like using the word explosive testing. You've heard, if you read my article on our GSR, Global Security Review, nuclear testing is thrown around.
That's a good one.
Yeah. And there's actually a picture of Curtis generated by AI on that article. So now you've got to go see it. See,
handsome pick him, devil.
Pick him out. Well, it's actually the back of his head, but that's okay. Anyway, but what I find interesting is, you know, the only people that have really been doing explosive nuclear testing have been the North Koreans. They are unsure of their nuclear fleet sufficient that they have to, you know, saber rattle by setting off nuclear weapon tests. But what they're also talking about in this article is non-nuclear explosive testing, which is this B6112 article I was going to read to set this up. But anyway, my point is that what is most of the testing? If you go back and look at testing of our nuclear weapons and nuclear work that was being done when we were actively testing, and since the stockpile stewardship program has begun, and what our adversary has been doing, most of the tests are designed to either understand how environments might cause the nuclear weapon to fail. And again, a failed nuclear weapon is not a deterrent. And so we test to make sure that we don't have failures. And so do our adversaries. And the other one is, and most people don't get this, and I want to hear from our anti-nuclear crowd, and that is, if you're going to have nuclear weapons, a lot of the tests are designed to be able to analyze non-nuclear tests, non-nuclear yield, our safety. And not performance related, but safety related. How can we keep them safe? What happens if fill in the blanks? What happens if one explosion occurs next to another? What happens if it falls off a truck? What happens if it catches fire? All these things are built in and engineered specifically into weapons. And might I remind our audience that because of this, we have yet to see one nuclear weapon accidentally go off. Even though we had many, many accidents, we haven't had any nuclear yield from a nuclear bomb accident because of the great engineering of our national labs, and even our adversaries do the same. I mean, it would not be good for Russia to have in one of their, you know, bunkers or whatever, nuclear weapons accidentally going off. That would not be a good thing for them. It would not be a good thing for the community and for people. I wished we would, you know, people weren't dying from other things. We were spending time other places. But the reality is they have the same kind of interest to have a secure, safe, and reliable weapon system. And that includes safety testing, which needs to go on, performance testing, so they know what they can do or can't do, and they know what's going to happen. So this article, every time I see someone saying, well, if we're testing, everything is going to go bad. Well, historically, that didn't happen. Historically, we were testing since the 60s, and we downscaled our nuclear weapons, or we followed treaties, et cetera, et cetera. And all of a sudden, what, everyone's going to change now? Give me a break. What do you think, Curtis?
Well, I think we've been testing since the 40s. And,
yes.
again, the world has endured over 2,000 nuclear tests, and it's still here. this question about escalation, I think, though, is really this reference to if we were to test first, then all the others would sort of, the genie would be out of the bottle. Everybody would start testing again.
You mean explosive testing?
Explosive testing, correct.
Yeah, okay. Well,
or
we did it before.
Okay, so let me actually read. So explosive testing, yes. But actually, this is also about going beyond the zero yield testing. Mm-hmm. Our intelligence community has publicly stated that some of our adversaries have violated the zero yield testing since 2019.
And right away, everyone else started doing it.
Right. Sorry. And so these are issues that I think are more political than anything else. But I will note that, of course, when India tested in 98 and Pakistan tested in 98, no one else tested. When all the three or four times or the three or four different year sets that North Korea tested, no one tested as a reaction to that. Now, I don't know if it's because we don't, you know, we kind of don't take North Korea seriously as much as we should, or whatever the case may be. But of course, this isn't America, Russia or China conducting a test that is so pervasive that it can be seen or calculated or monitored or detected, or however you want to calculate it. I don't expect that China testing would jump out there and say, "Hey, we're going to test, so you might want to pay attention." We would have to detect that. I mean, even when Chernobyl blew in the 1980s, that wasn't reported. The Soviets didn't report it. It was detected. With greater radiation in the air discovered up more towards the Nordic states than even in the southeastern part of Europe. So it really is about reaction. And so this escalation then of, well, if we test, they'll test. But President Trump was quite clear when he said, you know, we'll match them. And so I think if they go first, you know, we talked about this in a previous podcast, Jim, that if they go first, you know, we may not have a choice but to go second. But I don't expect that even President Trump is going to try to test first. I mean, explosive test first. I think that we will try to wait. But this is a methodology of the threat is escalatory. Just as Putin, when he threatened at first to move forces, nuclear forces into Belarus, when they unratified the CTBT, the testing treaty, and so forth, these were all methods of escalation without actually doing anything, right? These are just saying, we're going to change the status of this quo, and we're going to let you know that we're serious and we're taking things serious. It's about messaging and signaling more than anything else. So, yeah, that's my thought on that.
Yeah, I just get a little tired of the sort of the run for the hills. I mean, you mentioned, you know, Chernobyl, the Chernobyl accident, but you know, going back and looking again, we tend to worry about what's going to happen instead of look back and say what did happen and use that as our example. I mean, after all, we set the standard in 1972. No more reprocessing. We're not going to do it because the world will follow. Well, we throw away a lot of our nuclear material because France reprocesses, you know, Russia reprocesses, you know, China reprocesses. We're not going to test. I mean, we're already testing. But the other piece of this is we are not, you know, I don't think it's going to be escalatory any way than anything else, as you mentioned, is escalatory. So, and we do escalate. We escalate a little bit. We see what the reaction is. And Russia's been doing that for years. Whatever. We haven't been testing. We didn't test since 1992, but that didn't stop North Korea from wanting to test. Explosive test, that is. But we're still testing. Okay. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, my friend. And we only got to, well, you did three articles in one because you wanted to capture the word. So
the trend. I needed the trend.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to stop that next time. We'll see what happens at the December roundup. Maybe
was Nuclear November. And essentially for Nuclear November, it was Cruise Missile Month.
Yeah, it certainly was. I found a lot on that. So so to our audience, we really appreciate you. We hope you have a very happy holiday. We hope these news articles and news roundups give you something to think about, talk about. Consider, as always, write back to us at nids@thinktheturns.com if you have ideas or comments, want to be on the show, want to come up with a show idea. By all means, this is our way of communicating to you, to your friends, to your family. So let them know about our podcast. Let's get our numbers up going into 2026. Everything we do is about getting the world from the very top leadership to the very lowest person, to include even me, all right, to think deterrence, which, by the way, I didn't really think about deterrence when I was doing a lot of the technical work, Curtis. I know you were, because you're always thinking deterrence. But me, I had to sort of come on board, and that's where I am now. So for our audience, we wish you the very happiest of holidays. We hope you enjoyed November. December's got some big things. I'm sure we'll have a lot to talk about. And as always, we at NIDS want you and your family and your friends and everyone you talk to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View. NIDS Podcasting Network.